Most people listening to this podcast will have considered some form of childcare. Babysitters, childminders, nurseries, nannies, it's a frickin' nightmare. Trying to find someone who's top-notch but flexible is the holy grail. The top-notch people seem to want to work 800 hours a week, and the flexible people, well, one budding babysitter once said to me, as long as you stay in the same room as them, it's okay, isn't it? If you're still looking for the right childcare arrangement, then maybe consider B&Co. They offer a highly individual, first-class service tailored to your needs. Their sitters are all creative people, actors, dancers, artists, which makes for a more engaging, creative experience. One sitter recently helped my kids at bath time, and when I came in the room, they were all pretending to be gorillas. But don't just take my word for it.
I recommend them all the time, mostly because they're all actors, which means they are all playful, usually all quite bright. Actually, they're always bright and jolly and uncomplicated, and they're ad hoc. So you don't have to have them all the time. And if you book them and then you need to cancel because a job doesn't come through or the rehearsal schedule changes, then you can cancel within a certain amount of notice and then you don't pay, which is way better than paying for a nanny all the time.
That's B&Co, who are offering £25 credit to anyone signing up using the referral code TRAPDOOR2019. Now back to the podcast. Hello and welcome back. My guest this week is Sadie Hasler, columnist, actor, playwright. Her plays Pram Kicker and Fran and Lenny have been performed all around the world, and she's kind of a genius and brilliant at writing sassy roles for women. I saw her play Pram Kicker back in 2015 when I was pregnant with my son, and it was particularly interesting because it was basically a discussion about women and motherhood and the fact that women are still valuable, even if they don't choose to have kids. She has then gone on to have a beautiful daughter. She's, I'm sure, many other things, but I happen to follow Sadie on Instagram and she is properly, properly cute. I've obviously named my own daughter after Sadie. I haven't really, but you know, probably subconsciously somewhere, I thought she was great. And yeah, maybe I have named my daughter after her. Now that's an intro. She came to see me the other day and we sat down in the recording studio, which for some reason that day there had been placed a bottle of gin by our microphones. I don't know what that says. And it kind of turned into a sort of therapy session in a very good way. And Sadie immediately turned the questions on me.
Do you think that's a uniquely female thing to feel paranoid about why you're either being lucky or being recognised for something or being given something or, you know... Because as younger women, the temptation is to think, is he after something?
Yeah.
But obviously in a professional capacity, you don't always think that, particularly as you get older.
But I think there is a thing, isn't there, that women tend to think that they're owed less and that they're less worthy,
yeah,
and that men tend to think that they're more worthy and that they're owed more.
There's always, particularly, maybe it's a British thing, it's always good or seen as good to have an element of self-deprecation in the right context. As well as it's always, and now particularly in this age of social media, bigging yourself up and all that stuff that I can't stand, but you know you've got to play the game, otherwise you feel out of the game.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you have to kind of do the bigging yourself up thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like just now, I was a little bit early to come here and chat to you, and I thought, right, what do I want to do? Do I want to mooch around getting hot and sweaty, or do I want to sit somewhere and sod it, have a glass of wine?
Yeah.
So I did, and I did what I hardly ever do, which is take a selfie and posted it saying, I'm getting really good at stealing the moments to just sit quiet and be on my way to do a podcast. And, and I hated myself for posting it.
Yeah.
For putting myself in the game and doing that whole, I'm here, I'm doing this, blah, 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 blah.
But because I follow really you gives a crap? On social media and you don't have that persona. So I don't think, so I think that's the difference. Because I'm always quite shocked when people, not shocked, but you know, when people talk about social media and everyone's so up themselves and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, actually not the people that I follow, because I wouldn't follow them if they were.
Because it's curated, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, I love your posts and you're just really real and lovely, and I love your kids. I've never met your kids.
Which is luckily lucky. Otherwise you'd be like, unfollow. But yeah, but that is very much like, for me, that just started as like, I had loads of family abroad and it was like a way of showing them pictures of my kids.
It's lovely.
And also when I'm just with my kids for ages, like just taking a picture and putting it on Instagram is like a kind of like sending a, it's like a message in a bottle kind of thing. It's like, I'm here.
It is.
You know, so it's
there's
that.
A massive sense of invisibility after having a baby, isn't there?
Yeah, totally.
And yet in some ways feeling the most visible you've ever been because everyone is asking you stuff and really personal stuff as well. And you just think, actually, do you know what? Go away.
Yeah.
But
there's so much in that. I mean, so going back to the social media thing, I don't think that would be something that would even cross my mind looking at your, because you're not like that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So if you actually then, because then that's a moment that you're genuinely quite proud of, because you're just like, I've had this moment, I've got here a bit early and I can have a glass of wine and, you know, fucking bully for me. Like, that's really good. And so I think most people would be like, they'd be really happy for you for having that moment.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Maybe, again, it's that paranoia and maybe it is... heightened post-birth, coming back to the paranoia thing.
Yes, so you were saying that you were wondering whether that comes, that kind of paranoia comes after...
Yeah. God.
Now, this is interesting, because I don't know if you heard the episode with Carrie Ad Lloyd.
I didn't.
But she talked about that, and it was quite interesting, because she was actually linking sort of death. You know, her father died when she was 15, and so she felt that she had a kind of... and anxiety came from that, in the sense that, you know, if people would say things like, oh, that would never happen, she's like, but it did. It did one time. You know, so that's a natural thing, but she said it really intensified after having children.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that sense of kind of something, someone you love being sort of out of your control and in potential harm's way.
Oh, God, it's terrifying.
And combined with a really fierce imagination meant that you can then, your brain can like imagine those dark
plus
steps.
Being in comedy, which plumbs the roots of all you know, darkness and weird quirky human shit.
So what's your experience of that?
Oh, I think, do you know what, I had a conversation with my mum this morning on the phone and we were talking about loads of things, but she was talking about things she wanted to do to make herself feel better. And I was talking about things that, you know, I'd like to do that I never feel like I have time for, like getting some exercise, make myself feel physically like I'm not just curling up and dying with a laptop.
Yeah.
You know, and especially now that, you know, next year I'm 40, so I'm not 25 anymore, all that sort of stuff. And I just said, oh, I just feel so angry and I don't recognize my personality, because I've never been an angry person. I've never been combative. I've never had rows. Just not that person. Always chilled out, always looking for the good in things. Don't get annoyed at people, whatever. And now I'm just like, rah. Not outwardly.
No,
I don't actually have rows with people or whatever, but I just feel this anger. And she just said to me, maybe it's your anger because of your dad.
Yeah.
My dad took his own life when I was 23, coming out now you've had Marcy.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't talk, because I just was like, I haven't even thought about that. And I wonder if that is, it's just, you know, pregnancy hormones and post-baby hormones, whatever lingers after having a baby.
Do you think...
dragging out everything else that you've not dealt with, I don't know.
Yeah, and I do think that you're especially if you have children, or what, in my experience, having children after a parent has died, there's like it's the final part of your relationship with that parent, because there's the last little piece of the puzzle that you might not have understood before that you can then place. So like whatever that means in the context of your situation or your parent or whatever, or how old you were and all that kind of thing.
I think you're not the child anymore.
And you're not the child anymore, yeah.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I've not really had time to process it because it was this morning, but it's the first time. Because I've always insisted that I've never felt angry about what Dad chose to
do.
I just felt obviously sad and grief and everything negative other than anger.
Yeah.
But maybe there's anger there. Maybe I've just got to fucking deal with that now.
With the baby.
Good luck with that. Yay!
Yeah.
Having said all that, paranoia as well.
Back to your thing of paranoia.
Having said all of that, I do think for me, all feelings are more heightened since having kids. Like my, and I do feel, I think I've always slightly repressed. I've always thought of myself as not an angry person, and I think everyone's angry.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one of the things that we, you know, it's one of our emotions that everyone has anger.
Mm.
But I think I've always kind of like pushed it down. And now I will get angry about things.
For what reason? To be nice outwardly to people?
I think I don't. I think there was a lot of chaos in my life as a kid, and there was a lot of anger around. And I think I just thought it was easier. I've always been honest with my feelings. So it's not like I've been repressed.
Mm.
But if there's a way of getting out of a you know, I've always been a very good negotiator.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been good at sort of like talking things through and then getting to the other side, which I'm proud of, and that's good. But it also means that sometimes I'll over-intellectualise because I won't want to scream and shout and get annoyed. And sometimes actually screaming and shouting and getting annoyed is like a cathartic good thing to do.
Yeah.
And you should be able to do it and not... And the people who really love you will let you do that.
Do you think that's an age thing as well? Because I feel like maybe getting older, where you just reached the point where you just think, I'm not going to put up with this anymore.
No,
I am not a young idiot. I've been in many situations. I'm an intelligent woman. I've dealt with a lot of crap.
Yeah.
I've been through a lot of things and come out stronger and...
You know what?
I'm not just going to do it.
But that's funny enough. I think the stuff that makes me angry, and maybe that is like it's a lifelong experience that is suddenly coming out at 43.
Mm.
So like, you know, from in terms of being a woman, being brought up by a single mum who's now not with us, you know, all this kind of thing where I kind of go, you know, I sort of feel a bit like, that's my cross that I'm carrying, which is ridiculous because I'm not a single mother. And I don't know that there's something,
that something punctured your life and made it imperfect.
Yeah.
And you now are dealing with it, although it's not constant, but every now and then it finds its way back into your life and you have to deal with it.
Yeah, like, for instance, I realised talking to a friend of mine at the weekend who's a single mum, and then she was saying how she finds it quite difficult, some school events and stuff, because she finds it harder. There was like a thing where they all went camping. She was like, I was kind of dreading it, wasn't going to go because I still feel like it's much harder to go on
mums, dads and kids?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's hard.
Yeah, so she's like all these sort of nuclear families, like toasting marshmallows and all this kind of thing. And she's like, but she went and it was good and blah, blah. And when she was describing it, I found myself feeling angry.
Mm.
And then I thought, oh, that's because I was in that family of like feeling a little bit awkward on the outside. And in the 80s, like my mum was told by her friends, oh, we would invite you, but it's just, you know, odd numbers.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Odd numbers? Fuck off.
Like, how
the fuck is that?
And also, what are you supposed to do? Go, oh, yeah, sure.
I understand.
That would be a nightmare.
Yeah. Odd numbers, dreadful. It's all about the evens.
Crazy, isn't it?
That's awful.
Yeah. Awful. But yeah, maybe that's where those kind of things have just sort of lain low and weren't important to me as a kid. And now, as I'm an adult and a mother, I kind of get angry on my mum's behalf. That means your mum did a good job, right? Yeah, maybe.
Because I was feeling that recently. I was remembering how we had no money as kids. And my mum really struggled and, you know, used to count pennies out of a massive bottle in the kitchen just to go and get bread and stuff. And I look back and that just seemed so normal to me. I had no concept that we had no money and that she was struggling. I had no idea how depressed she was after splitting up with my dad, how hard my dad was, the fact that, you know, he, as a difficult man, let's put it that way, was still in her life, even though she'd had the guts to break up with him.
Yeah.
And I had a blissful childhood.
Yeah, gosh.
And she did an amazing job.
That's quite rock solid, isn't it? Just to...
And but so the anger on their behalf is stronger because you think, God, all that stuff I wasn't aware of. And now I feel like I've let you down by being blithely unaware of...
Yeah. God, this is like a therapy session.
In a good way. Should we open that gin boat?
Yeah, I think so.
Hello? Is it a microphone?
I went to see your play Pram Kicker in Edinburgh. Was that the first time you did it?
That done it before? We had done it in Brighton for Brighton Festival and in a few other places.
Right, okay. So
we weren't feeling too nervous about it.
So you did it up there and I was pregnant with my son and I just found it was so brilliant because for people who haven't seen it, it's and please correct me because it's been a while since I've seen it, but they're two women, two sisters.
Yeah.
One of them is wondering whether or not she wants to have kids. The other one is absolutely anti, definitely doesn't want to have kids. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of their journey through that conversation, which I'm assuming was your conversation in your head. Or somehow was, you know, like, am I going to do this or am I not? And why do I want to do it? Is it just society telling me to do it?
It started off mainly being a play. Sarah and I were in a cafe and there were some...
Who plays the other?
She plays Pram Kicker herself.
Right.
And Sarah has always known she doesn't want kids. And I played the character who doesn't know, could go either way. And it always started off as a play that wanted to be about the right to stay child free and the fact that you are still worth something as a woman and everything. And then as I was writing it, the sister became much more developed and for me much more what I was going through. You know, I thought I might want kids but I didn't know in what circumstance, and you know, and finding the right love first.
A lot of people's answer is, you know, when you say, when did you first decide to have kids? And they've gone, I just didn't want to regret not having kids. I didn't want to be 10 years down the line and thinking, oh, I wish I'd done that.
And you just don't know when that's going to kick in either.
No.
You could be any age and that kicks in, you know.
This is a very kind of outward process of that decision, or was it?
It became so, I mean, it started off as very, you know, I just want to write something for Sarah and I, something feisty, something about modern women, something about everything that we go through. But as we went on, it became, and I did it while pregnant as well. The last time we performed I was pregnant. So I've played it in all sorts of states of mind as we've toured it and gone all over with it. And so it's been very different things to me. Whereas I guess Sarah's character Jude, who doesn't want kids, is been quite,
has sort of stayed in its,
the same thing. Not changed her mind. She knows she doesn't want children, but she has then obviously had to play it knowing that I've got a baby. I mean, you know, we've had to tweak the play so that there's a scene where we're dancing. I don't know if you remember this silly dirty dancing thing. I run and jump and kind of land on her legs and she does the dirty dancing lift. I was like, fuck, I'm not doing that, little baby in my tummy. I was fiercely protective. I was like, nah. And we changed it. So she's had to kind of, you know, rethink things.
And how do you... So that's... So having had your daughter, does what you thought parenthood would be like, or how you thought, in inverted commas, parents were or mothers were, has that changed how you've seen it?
I think in some ways, and I am touching wood, because I know it's going to bite me in the arse at some point, in some ways, parenting is easier than I thought it would be, in that I could never imagine on quiet days sitting for a day with CBeebies on in the background and playing and talking and just keeping a small person happy. Yeah. I couldn't imagine doing that. And of course the day flies by and obviously some days don't fly by, they drag.
Yeah.
But that sort of day-to-day thing and just loving them and love eclipsing the boredom.
The drudge. Yeah.
That, you know, that is slightly easier, and I know it will change because she's only 15 months old. But, but the thing that I found hard is the adjusting to your feelings, particularly if they're feelings that aren't ones you're used to, like anger and paranoia.
Right, yeah.
And just replacing yourself in a world as a professional woman as well.
Yeah.
While looking after your baby and dealing with the guilt that you know.
Yeah.
So how
have you done that? So you've written a play since having her, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I don't quite know how I've done it because I really don't. But I think if it had been a case of me and Sarah just saying, let's work on the next play, it never would have happened.
No.
But because Queen's Theatre came to me and said, right, we'd like you to write this, and because there is that sense of survival of thinking, well, I need to earn money.
But also great, though.
And amazing.
Amazing.
It's my first commissioned job as a playwright.
That's brilliant.
And I just had literally just had the baby.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, this is not going to give me the chance to just sit there feeling like I'm not in the game anymore.
No, So how did you do it, practically?
I could not have done it without the two nans. Yeah, my mum and George's mum, Susan, are amazing.
Right.
And they have Marcy, you know, a day a week each.
Yeah, right.
Sometimes more when needed.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's still not a lot of time when you think normally you'd really go down the hole to try and write something.
But
it's been amazing.
But do you find that is more helpful or is it difficult to break out of your creative mindset or...
I think it just takes me longer to get back in it. It's like going down the mine. You're not just there. You can't just throw yourself there. There's that descending and that period of altering your brain and your surroundings to fit with what you've got to do. But I don't know. It's been really hard. It's just been slow. Just, you know, and you can't do your usual staying up till 3 a.m. if you want to on your laptop because you know the next day it would just make you miserable. But there's no way I could have done it without those two women.
Makes
me feel quite emotional talking about them, actually, because I don't know how women do it who don't have people close to them.
They have to somehow pay for a bit, like, I mean, that's the thing,
and I
it?
Wouldn't have been able to do that.
No,
I wouldn't have been able
to
afford to to find someone brilliant.
Open the front door and I can go out.
I was listening to this podcast that was talking about how, I don't know how true this is, but they seem to think it was true, where they were saying that working women now still spend more time with their kids than, say, the stay-at-home mums of, like, the 70s and 80s.
Really?
Because when they're home, they're so much more present than their...
Right.
You know, so, like, there might have been women who were at home, but they were constantly busy. Maybe there were domestic things that took longer than they take now.
Yeah.
But also... because that was their world, they protected their own sort of leisure time in a way that we don't.
And men probably put more pressure on them in terms of, right, tonight, darling, we're out for drinks with the A-casters or whatever.
Yeah, and you've got to look like, you know, you've got to look like this.
Got to have been shopping for a new dress.
Yeah.
Get your hair done, because hair was much more of a
thing. Exactly, exactly. So, you know, it was quite interesting because it was sort of saying that, you know, as... working mothers, we, and I say that lightly because I'm very lucky in that I still spend an awful lot of time with my kids. Like, I, you know, I'm not working every day. But yeah, that the downtime that we have is just with our kid. You know, yeah. I'm not just kind of like, I don't know, putting the kids in the garden while I don't know what I would do. Put makeup on, paint my nails. Do you know what I mean? I don't know what my mum would have done. But I also know that, yeah, my mum would have, like, dropped me off with a neighbour while she went out to do... There was much more of a sense of community, I guess, then as well.
Yeah.
So on our road, we knew everyone down our road, and we'd, you know, we'd come home, and if mum wasn't there, we'd let, you know, like, we'd go and stay with a neighbour. We'd be in with a neighbour until she came back. You know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, see, that's nice.
That just, yeah, really nice. But that was... I mean, I guess it was a long time ago, but... You know, that was the 80s, and that was in London. You know, yeah. It wouldn't happen now, I don't think. It depends, maybe, where you lived.
But yeah, now you'd have to, you know, plan who was picking up the baby.
Yeah, of course.
And it would be this kind of logistical thing where... Yeah.
And now, if that happened... I mean, there's so many things that we did as kids that if it happened now, you'd be reported... Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
if,
God,
if so,
yeah.
If that happened, several times this woman isn't home and her kids come home, and do you know what I mean? And she has to come around.
Or kids of a certain age walking to school,
yeah,
and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so hard because we have lost something in that. I know that we have to. The world has changed, or our awareness of certain people within the world has changed, and you know we have to protect people we love and children and innocence. Especially when innocence is so hard to keep now.
Yeah.
But you do wish that you could just say, right,
yeah,
pop up the road for, you know, some bread and milk.
Yeah, and also there's a thing.
Feel safe.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And also in terms of resilience and, you know, like, it's quite funny because both me and my husband were very much from quite a young age sort of expected to be quite self-sufficient.
Mm.
And we were, and we did that. So in a way, what we find difficult is asking for help. We're definitely the kind of people who go, oh, don't worry, we've got this covered.
Yeah.
It's quite hard when you're married to someone who's like that.
It's so hard.
Because you're like... Because that's what I really like about him. Yeah. But there's also like, just let me do this because I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh no, he knows what he's doing too. God damn it. but it's funny because then you think, are we going to have the opposite kids? Are we going to do everything for our kids so they'll be total wee-wees and not know how to go to the shop and get themselves a pint of milk? Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
there's a balance all the time of like looking after their welfare, but also... kind of, you know, letting them fail gently at things so that they get better at it, kind of thing.
And just learn to navigate their way around the world. I mean, just, you know, being out in the street and talking to people and who not to talk to. And
yeah.
Oh, God.
Yikes. I know.
Oh.
So tell me about, you had quite a tricky birth, if I remember rightly.
I always feel weird talking about it because I feel like, yes, I did have a tricky birth, but of course they're all, I would imagine,
none are plain sailing. Yeah. Yeah.
Apart from the women that go to the toilet thinking they need a wee and suddenly there's a head hanging out of
Although
them.
Although that's going to come at a price, surely.
I don't know.
I mean,
how does that even work?
Like,
how?
I don't know. I have to say, mine was pretty... good as it goes, in the sense that it was quite quick.
Yeah, you bitch.
Yeah, it was quite quick.
Yeah.
And it was obviously fucking painful, but over quickly.
Yeah.
And I liken it, I remember being at school and one of the girls going, I went to all-girls school, and one of the girls going, someone's mum had said that giving birth is like doing a poo. And I remember us all just really intense, just going, I'm so awful. I'd hate it if my mum said that. I mean, it's so awful. And now I'm like, she's right. That woman's fucking right. But in the sense that it felt like it was, with every push, it felt like it was moving.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that that's not the case for and also, a lot of people, and that pressure, must feel so shit.
The pressure that is on your body feels like it's very much the back and not the front.
Yeah.
So it does, without going too anatomical, it does feel like, oh my God, this isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I felt, what I mean is that I felt in the same way as doing a poo, I felt that it was moving.
Yes.
So at least with that, you kind of know that it's, that with every push, something's happening.
Yeah.
Whereas I think, presumably, if you have a really long labour or whatever, that's not the feeling you have every time, and it's just a fucking nightmare.
I didn't get that sense at all. It was 2 days of just not much happening, and then every time they checked on me, and I went through the various, you know, there's me starting off thinking, yeah, just remember my hypnobirthing, it's going to be great.
Oh, man.
And then going through the various things of pethidine, gas and air, hormones, sweep, waters being broke, all sorts. Yeah, of, I can't even remember the order of it. I was in such a daze. And then finally, I knew that it wasn't going my way. And I think they'd said that after all that, I was only 1 centimetre or something. And I just said, okay, epidural time now, because I can sense this is not going to be fun times. So I had that. Oh, it was just horrible. Anyway, 2 days. But I had one bit where they said, I think we can get the head to the bit where you're ready to push.
Right.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
And so I did do a bit of pushing.
Right.
And that sense of feeling it getting there. They were like, oh my God, it's almost there, it's almost there. We can see the hair. And then I just was like, oh my God, you can see the hair. And she was a hairy little baby.
Yeah.
But then it was taken out of my hands because the doctor came in and said, why isn't this happening? And basically checked everything and didn't think it was safe. And then I got whipped down the corridor to theatre, and she came out with forceps and a bit of snipping. But I did have that moment, and I hang on to that because that's the one bit where I think, I did a proper bit of birth, just getting her head ready.
I would say the whole thing was pretty proper. You gave birth to a human being.
Oh, I know. Like, but again,
but isn't that awful?
That pressure where I felt, because I didn't do the pushing to get her whole body out, because someone took over and
but hang on, you did, because you got her to the exit.
I did.
And that's the hardest bit.
So it was probably, I think, I don't know, and I keep meaning to request my birth notes, actually, just as a jolly little little
read. It's funny, because they keep them, don't they?
Yeah.
It's so weird. Why do they keep them?
Well, the reason why I was going to request them was because I did, the midwife, I was in hospital for a week afterwards, which was like torture, because Marcy was in special care. Well, it was horrible.
Yeah.
And then the midwife came in when Sarah, pram kicker, came in and was having a little visit. And she just started reading my notes to me. She was like, oh, yeah, because of course you feel like that because of this, blah, 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 blah. And she told me that I'd lost half my blood in theatre. And something about the maths of that and the kind of half life, half death, half your blood is out on the floor, which I had seen, but you don't know how much blood is in you.
No. So when you had forceps, you lost a lot of blood? Or before then?
They had to give me an episiotomy.
Oh, man.
Which, amazingly, and I'm, maybe we'll talk about the female body afterwards, if you can be bothered.
Yeah.
But, and I don't really know where... I think I had internal bleeding as well.
Yeah, right. Oh, man.
Because I had gauze and everything. This is too physical, right? I'm going to stop. No,
I mean, if it is for you, I mean,
I'm disgusting.
The thing I was so scared about was an episiotomy.
Yeah,
which is when they basically cut you so to make a bigger hole.
Yeah,
and I tore, I think, both of my births. Definitely one of them. You see, I can't even remember. And
it's mental,
and
isn't it?
I didn't even feel it. So that's how fucking it's painful crazy. It is you don't even feel it. And I remember as a kid, you know, my mum saying, oh, you're in so much pain, you wouldn't even feel that. And I'm like, I don't believe that could possibly be the case. Well, believe it, baby, because,
I had episiotomies weren't even on my radar until I went to NCT.
Right, yeah.
And then when it happened, I was so, it changed my whole, that more than birth, I think, the actual passing a baby.
Yeah.
Affected my relationship with my body and my female parts for months after, even now, you know, I was terrified of looking at it, terrified of feeling it, terrified of washing it. I did wash, though. but do you know what I mean? And then afterwards, you kind of look at it with a mirror and you're like, fucking hell, I'm Harry Potter.
I am
the woman who lived, and the scar is cool. But also, it's not that visible.
No.
Like, any person going down there... Yeah. It's not going to think,
and
what
also,
the fuck is that?
No, and also much better to get one of those than to tear, like
I
did.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So,
I know someone, and this is quite common, who pretty much tore all the way to the, I can't remember what they call it, when you basically tear from one hole to the back hole.
Oh, yeah, I don't know what that's called.
Jesus Christ.
But, yeah.
And I remember a friend of mine who was pregnant at the time, and her husband was a surgeon. And he was walking out of theatre and he'd walked past two people who'd been in a room where a woman had been given birth. And the two doctors or midwives or whatever walked out, and one turned to the other and went, it's like a grenade's gone off down there.
Oh, fuck.
And he skipped home and told his wife because he thought it was so funny. And she was like, oh, my God, why did you tell me that?
It's crazy.
I remember that for a long time. Yeah, it can be really bad. Anyway.
But I say this to quite a few, you know, NCT friends and stuff. No one really talks about that side of it.
No.
You know, the aspect is always on, if I'm passing something massive out of me, things are going to be changed afterwards. And that's all you really think about.
But also, I mean, as you've also said, I kind of assumed that it would just be changed, and it is changed forever, but not really.
It's not really.
Like, it kind of does, even when you've been a bit, you know, ruffled.
Yeah.
I don't know what it's like for the people who have, like, a full-on... And it's, but, like, mostly, it does bounce back, and that's what's so amazing.
It's incredible. It's
Isn't
so
it?
Incredible.
Yeah.
I was just about to be too graphic again, but I won't. But, yeah, there have been times where I just thought, ooh, okay, wow.
Yeah.
Still got it. Yeah.
Stop talking! I'm gonna get frustrated.
So we talked about the practical aspect of finding time to write.
Yeah.
And also the kind of like going under takes longer.
Yeah.
But how do you find that you're writing about different things? Do you find that you're...
I don't necessarily feel like... I mean, maybe it would have been different if I'd been writing... If I'd sat down and thought, right, what do I want to write about next? Maybe it would have been completely different. Like, I'm doing Latitude in, next month, and I was supposed to be writing a new show called Cunts and Flowers, which was going to be a big, messy, silly, funny exploration of the female body and different ages and all sorts of stuff with Sarah. And I just ran out of time. So I thought, oh, God, I've got to cancel Latitude. And I was dreading it. And I did actually send the email. And then I thought, hang on, why don't I just do Pram Kicker? Because it's up our sleeve.
Yeah.
But to take way less work to kind of get it on its feet again. And they were up for it. But, yeah, if I'd had to sit down and write that show, it probably would have been completely different now that I'm a mum. But this, my new play, Stiletto Beach, because they came to me and said, we want you to write a play challenging the Essex girl stereotype. And I'm a South End girl, so I'm surrounded by this stuff I've been with my whole life. There was, like, a bag of tricks to go into, as it were.
But your daughter is also a South End girl.
Yeah.
So how does that...
By birth, and I'm not. I'm London via Leicester and then ended up in South End when I was six. So
how does that... Does writing that story mean more now that you have your own little Essex girl?
Yeah, because you do think about what the world is going to be like for her as a woman and as an Essex woman. And whether by that point it will, you know, the stereotype will have dissipated.
Do you think it had? I mean, I remember as a kid, we had like an Essex girl joke book.
Was
just like, that was kind of...
Yeah. I think the jokes changed.
Right.
I think the language around it has changed. It's not so much like there's a very 80s vibe to a lot of the old Essex Girl stuff, like dancing around your handbag,
white stilettos.
All of that stuff seems quite passé in terms of it being a visual language, whereas now it's moved on to these, to the fake tan and a certain...
And Towie had
a massive effect, and in some... I can't say, I've only ever watched one episode... But the whole culture and the whole jokes that have come out of Towie make me, as an Essex female, quite impatient. And annoyed.
What kind of joke? Because, again, I've never seen...
Ha-ha, boom-boom, knock-knock jokes.
But just
us being not seen as not quite your average Englander. Person, like, still the butt of the joke, as subpar intellectually, seen as being quite gauche and gregarious in an embarrassing way, and women to be overtly sexual.
Where does it come from?
I think, and I my friend Sid would be much better at answering this because she's done a lot of research into the Essex female stereotype. She's written novels about Essex witches and stuff.
Right.
And she believes that the Essex girl stereotype can be tracked back to the persecution of women in the times of the witches.
Whoa.
the witch finder general times, and that was a lot of Essex stuff going on. And since then, any woman that is strong, sexual, don't quite know what to do with her, don't quite know what box she belongs in, someone with sort of a... And glamour is actually a word. Sid taught me this as well. The word glamour comes from those times or around those times, and it means someone with a bit of magic, someone who can have an effect, but in a supernatural sort of way.
Wow.
So that whole sex being a power thing has very much become part of why Essex women are kind of beaten with it a bit.
Yeah.
But coming back to your question,
yes.
I believe that play was easy for me to write because it was drawing on something that was already so part of me.
So rooted.
And Marcy didn't affect that.
Right, okay. And what next?
So that's about to go. We're auditioning for it at the moment and are finding some amazing women. We are rehearsing in August, and then it will be on from the 4th till the 28th of September at Queen's Theatre in Hornchurch.
Very good.
Yeah.
And are you then going to just, like, pick up your laptop and write something else?
Sarah and I are desperate get back to it and create something together. I've got the opportunity to develop Pram Kicker as a pitch for a TV company, which I've been sitting on for far too long, which is making me feel quite sick at the moment. And then after that, again, something else I put down for bloody ages. I wrote a book and I need to edit it. Yeah, so all this stuff that I've kind of got sitting there and haven't been able to do anything with. Yeah.
And this is something I ask everybody. Is what's the worst thing that anyone's ever said to you? Worst bit of advice or, like, throwaway comment or whatever since you were pregnant or you had a baby or anything like that?
God, it's so hard to pick one because some people do just say the most throwaway things and they don't know that they've niggled you.
No.
And again, it probably comes back to that paranoia thing of stuff that, you know, shouldn't bother you, but it does.
And wouldn't bother you later on, but right in the thick of it, it does, or that day or whatever,
I think, I can't think of a specific example, but I think it's when people have made the easy assumption that I might not go back to acting or writing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and in my head, I won't just think, oh, that's because they're picturing me having another life and finding something else and priorities changing. In my head, I'm like, you don't think I'm good enough.
Yeah, fuck, man.
And then I'm like, am I good enough?
Yeah.
But that, I think, as a female performer, it's particularly mental, isn't it?
Yeah.
And just that whole thing you've got to throw yourself into. And I think anyone that's said, oh, you're a writer now, you don't want to perform, I'm like, hey,
yeah,
hang on, I did pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
that thing of and someone ending something for you or sealing something up for you.
You feel that not just in your personal life, but with people in the industry, you think that they've assumed that you're not going to...
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not, that I'm not going to go back to it.
There's something that Anna Quilley said about... that she said that there's something awful about the grapevine, and that, you know, the reason it goes on for ages is that someone might say, oh, you know, they see someone somewhere and they go, oh, how's Anna Crilly? And she's like, she's just had a baby. Oh, right, she's just had a baby. And then that person sees someone else, you know, a year later, and they say, oh, how's Anna Crilly? Oh, she's just had a baby. Well, actually, she's 18 months by that point.
Yeah.
You know, so...
And she's been writing in that meantime, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. And that bit of news just stays static.
Yeah.
And rather than like, oh, well, actually, when did you hear that? And, yeah.
I wonder if there's something in the assumption that women... Because female performer, being a female performer, there's some sort of glamour and ambition to it that perhaps men don't kind of get tainted with. And if you then take the diversion into producing or writing or whatever the fuck you decide to do, because actually it's really satisfying, and it's great to create your own work, that some people see that as a failure because their mark of success is if I can't see you, if all your work is going on under the radar and you've only got something published, you're only writing something for a magazine, you're only writing for telly, not on it, then...
But also, I have started to... I remember sort of probably there was a point where I thought that, but I feel as I get older, probably because I have done that, is that as I evolve, my need to perform anyway isn't as acute as it was. Like, that's the least... Because for me, that's the last part of making something for me, the most control is in writing or producing or whatever,
and it's the most fun, I would say.
Yeah, and the least kind of harrowing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Especially if you're performing your own work, like, it can be quite hard.
Yeah.
So yeah, I wonder if that's... I've sort of thought that. I don't know if it'd been different if I just... If I'd become much more successful younger, maybe I wouldn't have hit that point. But I do feel like, I just don't feel the need.
Do you think something happens after you've had a baby where you just feel like you don't want to be as visible as you were? Because for whatever other biological reasons, you're not in the marketplace anymore. I mean, is it because it feels finite? I don't know. Does it feel like you can't go back down that path once you've gone down another one? I don't know. It's very weird. I'm kind of thinking about it at the moment. Because I had to read with some of the actors in the auditions the other day.
Yeah.
And I hated it.
Absolutely.
The thought of me being in the scene.
That's interesting.
I hated it.
Yeah. And no idea where that comes from.
No. You know, maybe 2 years ago, I would have been like, I can read this character. I'll be fucking funny.
Yeah.
And now I'm just like...
Not interested.
No, I just want to hear you be funny.
Yeah. No, that is interesting. I wonder what it is. Yeah, I definitely feel that. Not interested, really. I mean, I say that. There'll be all kinds of things that I'm... You know, I'm sitting here yabbering on. Do you know what I mean? It's not like I don't have ego, but it's like I just don't... It's not important to me. I think for me, performing, even though I wouldn't have thought it at the time, looking back, I think it had a lot to do with others' perception of me, which is why it was difficult when I didn't do well.
Yeah.
Because I felt like, you know, that feeling of a negative gaze on something I was doing was so crippling.
Yeah.
Whereas now I don't give a fuck what anyone else thinks of me, so I kind of... But then in a way that should make it easier. Oh, I don't know.
It is, strange.
Yeah.
Would you, if someone said to you, right, I've written this play, I want you to be in it, this is when we're going to work on it and I want you to be in it. Would you find that a much more fun process than either performing in something you've written, or that horrible thing, which is why I kind of stepped away from the performing and more into the writing,
the
of just going to castings and just
and in
that
the
is your
studios
life.
I was saying to you, you know, when I come here sometimes and they have auditions and they've got people sort of standing on the stairs holding the script like slightly shakily just before they go in, and I am so glad I don't still do that. It is such a horrible process, and I was so shit at it. The only things I ever were in were when people just gave them to me.
Same with me.
So it's like, I just, I just don't think I could do that. I don't think I could do that now.
I see it as a thief of time. Yeah, I think that's what, train for.
yeah.
I just think, well, I could be at home writing.
And also there's something about, I remember after like advert castings, and speaking to one of the guys I was in a sketch group with, and we used to kind of like, it was like a little self-help thing, and that's when we likened it to being a bit like a prostitute, where you just felt like they asked you to do anything. I remember being asked to rearrange biscuits on a radiator, and then I did it, and then the note was, okay, can you do that again and just look like you're a bit more into it? And I remember just thinking, what the fuck am I doing?
Yeah, it's mental.
I've got to do this because it's going to be loads of money. But, and of course I didn't get it, so you haven't done it, you haven't been paid for it, you've just been humiliated in a room where you've had to wait for 2 hours to be seen, and then, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's not cool.
No.
I wonder if the people who do well, obviously you've got to be talented, but also the people that just switch off to how fucking demeaning it is.
Who
go in and they're just like, I'll do that. Fine.
Me and Ingrid Oliver, we're in a pilot for a terrible sketch show, like 2006, something like that, and there were three guys and three girls. I can't really remember who the guys were, but it was me, Ingrid, and the other girl was Paloma Faye.
There we go.
And me and Ingrid were like, no, we're not. There was one, I mean, it was terrible, the sketches were terrible, but it was like we had to lift our tops up and show our bras, and we're like, no, we're not doing that, we'll just wear a vest underneath. We were talking about this the other day, and you were just like, well, that's fine, totally fine.
Did Paloma just get them out?
Yeah, but no, not that. But like, but just don't do the sketch, because by doing that, you've totally
ruined the joke.
It's a shit joke. But by just having like a vest top underneath, it's just a bit weird.
Yeah.
So, but of course, Paloma Faith was doing it all. There was one sketch we had to do where it was like a little potty, and she pulled her pants down, sat in the potty, and the guys were like, "You don't have to do that." She's like, "I'm all right, I'll do it." And now she's Paloma Faith.
Yeah.
And we're going, well, is that good? Is that God?
She wasn't Paloma Faith at the time.
No, because she was in...
2006.
Yeah,
God,
she was just like a... I just thought a kind of bonkers kind of like actress who was, you know, we were fresh out of Edinburgh. Do you know what I mean? We were all nobodies. But yeah,
because that would have been around the time I saw you in Edinburgh.
Yeah, it was that
and
time.
And I just remember laughing so hard at Fat Tongue.
Yeah.
And just thinking you were just the most minxy, mischievous, funny person. You know, when someone just comes on and smiles, like a little cheeky little pink pixie or something, and it's just joyful and funny.
Oh, that's really nice.
You didn't have to do anything, and you were just... Same with Ingrid, actually. She's one of those people, isn't she?
Yeah, you can just
come on and give a little cheeky little glimmer. And, yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, and I've always remembered that it was a very good show, very funny, and just joyful.
It was, I think, that year. It really was, because we were just having such a good time. It was very pure, I think. And then it got very quickly sort of, well, like most things, sort of you lose that initial verve, you know, of just like... being pure and coming up with ideas in the back bedroom
and difficult second album thing with sketch shows as well, isn't it? Yeah, we've done one that was like all our material and now we've got to write another hour's worth of...
I remember being in meetings with TV companies and stuff, and they would say things like, well, that's not a Fat Tongue idea. And I remember feeling jealous that they knew what that was.
Oh, right.
And then it'd be like, hang on a second, we're just... Do you know what I mean?
We are Fat Tongue.
Yeah.
Fuckers, we know that.
It's so surreal.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a funny old time. And so what bit of advice would you give somebody who is just about to have their first baby?
just go easy on yourself. Just do not. Don't read too much. I mean, there's such a. It's so hard to get the balance right between feeling prepared and knowing certain things and just knowing when to throw it away and stop reading these weekly charts of what's happening now and what to do now and what to expect and what the right thing to do is, because it's all so dependent on what your child is like and when they hit certain stages. And I think I just stopped reading stuff. Which may be a bad thing.
Maybe same. I sometimes
maybe
think
I'm
that
getting
like,
some
maybe
massive
I should
stuff
know.
Wrong. But I don't know. I think it is that. I mean, I've been better since having Marcy at just going, yeah, I'm going to get my hair done.
Yeah,
I'm going to get my hair cut. I don't care that it costs money that I wouldn't normally pay. Yeah. I'm going to do this, and I want to feel nice, and I'm going to do this. I'm going to go and sit in a pub outside the podcast studio and have a glass of wine.
Yeah,
because I won't have a glass of wine tonight. Take your moments for yourself and go easy on yourself and enjoy. It does feel like a club of just understanding other women and just really just appreciating stuff so much more, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Tomorrow I'll probably be like, I fucking hate everyone. Fuck off. I don't care. Don't have a baby. No, I won't. I wouldn't.
Thank you so much to Sadie Hasler for coming in to talk to me. There are many things we talked about that day that I still think about, and it was a real corker of a chat. So thank you, Sadie. And if you are interested in seeing her play Stiletto Beach, as she said, it's on at the Queen's Theatre in Hornchurch from the 4th to the 28th of September. So go see that. Also, I think they want donations of stilettos. She's written a play that requires quite a few stilettos as some kind of structure on the stage, because she's a clever lady who doesn't happen to have 500 pairs of stiletto heels. So if anyone wants to donate their stiletto heel, I think get in touch with the Queen's Theatre and hopefully they will tell you where to leave them or send them, and be part of theatrical history. My guest next week is the acting agent Sarah Camlett, who her job is for you not to know who she is. She represents lots of high profile actors, but she's had a particularly interesting journey as a mother, as she chose to do it alone, and she's got a 4-year-old daughter and a 5-month-year-old son, and it was all done through sperm donors and IVF. So that again is utterly fascinating, so tune in and I'll see you then.
Bye bye.